Mr. Hayward, Reel 18. Now, we've got to a point, you're not quite sure when exactly, but we can look this up later in the ward. I haven't got that part with me. When you entered in the Helmond area, there was a petrol shortage with the tanks. Now, how had this arisen? Do you know? Or what was the background?
I think it was largely... we weren't aware of it at the time, but from the account it seems that... the advance had been so swift that the supply situation hadn't caught up. They weren't coming up as swiftly because of the great distance we'd covered. And so there was this problem of getting, if the tanks were going to advance further, they would need backup in the form of petrol. Ammunition probably wasn't so acute, but petrol certainly was. And I do remember taking part in that trip to get petrol. It doesn't stick in my mind particularly as anything sort of out of the ordinary. It was just a journey. One trip, as far as I recall, brings back as much petrol as we could carry in the form of gel cans and dumping it, at a certain point, and then getting back to normal.
During this whole period, had you ever come under fire much, either from the air or long range? So I was thinking of other than the time of the Neverwolf, so I was thinking of the overall risk of driving an ammunition lorry. Were you very conscious of it when you came under fire? Or?
Well, there was one occasion, it must have been possibly during one of those daytime marches where we were. It might have been either before Amiens or after, but there was an occasion I remember when we were told by the sergeant to prepare for an attack by Germans who were trying to escape across country that had probably been bypassed. We always had that feeling that there might be some that had been left behind, and so on occasions like that. I believe I carried a rifle on the truck, and I liked the rifle as a means of defence, because at least you could shoot from a greater distance with a rifle than you could with a Stinger, and I felt happier with a rifle. And so, although I was a bit uneasy about the size of this supposed attack, I prepared sort of infantry fashion to use the rifle, and most of us got down into a dry ditch at the side of the road, having stopped our vehicles, and prepared for anything. I don't think we even knew which direction they were going to come from. But I think the country around there, apart from a few occasional houses, was fairly open. And so the soft vehicle drivers and any passengers they might have would position themselves facing in two directions, from the roadside both ways. But fortunately for us, nothing occurred. Somebody else had probably mopped them up.
And how about shell fire or anything like that? Was that only the one time with the Neverwolf?
Just that one there in Normandy when we were close. I don't remember being bothered by shell fire after we'd broken out of Normandy. Up was closer than Antwerp. I don't remember that sort of happening, bothering us.
And air attacks? Any air attacks?
Air attacks did occur occasionally, but nothing very close. It was later in the war that we became bothered by air attacks.
Were you very conscious of the fact you were on it was a bit of a high explosive situation.
Yes, I think I was vaguely conscious that I had to be prepared to get out of the vehicle pretty quickly, and of course it wasn't, well, I was young then and fairly agile, so I got used to how to get out of the vehicle quickly and how to get into it quickly, so that wasn't too much of a problem. The cab I was sitting in, of course, was metal, but it was very thin metal. I don't think it would have, I think even a bullet would have gone through it. So you weren't very well protected. I think the glass in the windows was triplex. I think it was safety glass of a sort. But as you say, yes, there was that certain amount of unease, but As time went on and nothing much happened, you began to get a little bit nonchalant about it and not too worried.
What about mines? I mean, you must have worried about that, surely. Or were you confident the roads were cleared?
I think we were. We kept a wary eye open on the road surface as we went along, but as we could see that other vehicles had been along there before us, we didn't worry too much about that.
Were you careful about backing off the roads in certain circumstances? You know, you weren't the front line, but when you go off the roads, you may have been the first off. Would you watch out for that sort of thing, turnings, things like that?
Yes, if I was on my own, I certainly would. But this sergeant I described, he was very, very good at keeping a watchful eye on the column. And in any places, for instance, when we came into a temporary harbour parking place, he would shepherd each individual truck into its position and use this sort of signalling of the fists. If you shook that way, then you had to pull over that way. Shook that way, then you had to pull over that way. That sort of backing treatment.
Would he have checked for mines first?
I can't help feeling that he probably wouldn't. I think he was too busy following his own instructions, that he would probably assume that somebody else had done that.
You obviously didn't have any trouble with mine, anyway.
We didn't, no, we didn't.
What about booby traps? Or were you advancing too quickly for that to be a problem?
Yes, you could say that. We probably were going too quickly for the Germans to have had time to do that.
Was it something you were worried about or warned about during that phase?
Yes, I think. In the Normandy area, we did come across one or two German trenches, some of them which had obviously been there a long time because they were sort of filled with all sorts of household comforts like mattresses and things, and we didn't linger too long around them because they had a peculiar smell about them that we were certainly never tempted to occupy them ourselves after the Germans had been in.
Because of booby traps.
That's one of the reasons, yes. We did sort of gingerly inspect some of them to see if we could find any booty, like leftover weapons or anything like that. I did acquire a German bayonet at one stage, and something else, or one of their leather belts with the God is with us, God mittens or something on the buckle. I acquired that, but I gave them years later to my younger brother and never saw them again. I expect he was at school at the time. He probably bartered them for some other goodies.
So, what's next then?
We got to Helmand, and I do remember at Helmand we were parked in a street with closely fitting houses, sort of terrace houses of different shapes and sizes, and we got to know the people in the house next to our truck quite well. I even have their address somewhere. I must have written to them through my last year. So they're very friendly. But of course, we didn't really get time to know them. We didn't know how long we were going to be there. We made use of any comforts that they could give us in the way of drinks, I suppose, and fruit and such like. I believe at night time, these Dutch folk, if we were anywhere near their houses, they would invite us in and even allocate a room in the house for us to sit in and write letters. I remember in particular one area, I think it was near Durban, where we went in one Dutch person's house, and something puzzled us. We could hear this murmuring going on in the background from another room, and we discovered eventually that the whole family wrote prayers. They were reciting some prayers in the other room. They must have been very strongly Roman Catholic or something. But that was, there was certainly a very religious atmosphere there. But they were very nice because they put on a special light, one of these pump-up lights, so they sort of work on either paraffin or petrol, and they work on a mentor, a guest mentor, and give a very powerful bright light, so they were able to write letters and things like that. But none of these occasions were for very long. We'd be moved on again very quickly.
Well, letters, let's talk about letters. Did you get letters from home or from anybody in GB?
Oh yes, we had an army regimental postman who, that wasn't his only job of course, he had other duties to perform, probably jobs to do with the squadron office no doubt, but we had a in name our regimental postman who would bring the mail round whenever we could. No doubt at times it piled up until there was an occasion where we could deliver it. When we were all together. But we did get mail, yes, it was very good.
Who would write to you?
Mainly my parents. I had one, my elder brother's wife would write to me and occasionally send me cigarettes in the envelope. And a favourite aunt in Bradford. She would also write occasionally. Perhaps once a month, once every 2 months. I don't think I could correspond with my school friend because we kept in touch mainly when we were on leave. We'd find out from the parents where the other one was and if he was likely to be on leave. But writing was mostly family.
And how many letters would you get a week? I mean, would your mother write weekly or...?
I think she would try to write weekly, yes.
Now was it important to you, your mail?
Yes, I think it was very important to be kept informed as to how the family were at home and what they knew of what we were up to, which wasn't very much, I think.
And would you write back to them, or would you just write back to your mum and she'd forward it?
Yes, I would write back to the individuals, yes, with their own addresses.
And what would you write about? Because you're quite restricted from censorship, aren't you?
Yes, it would be very mundane things like getting enough to eat and that sort of thing, and perhaps complaining because I couldn't get shaved or washed that day or something. There would inevitably be some amount of moaning in the letters, which I regret afterwards. So I don't think many people back home really wanted to hear that sort of thing. But it did creep into the letters. As you say, there wasn't really much we could disclose. We couldn't say where it was.
Were you aware of the censorship? I mean,
yes.
Did it press on?
Oh, yes. Yes, we were aware of that.
Did they have the green envelope system where you could write private letters? Well, they weren't censored in the unit.
I don't remember that.
Were they airgrams or were they proper letters?
They were proper letters, ordinary letters, and we had to mark them on active service or something like that at the top. So we didn't need a stamp.
What about parcels? Did you get any of them?
Yes, I think there was the occasional parcel. In my case, I don't remember many because I don't think I needed much. I certainly didn't really need any cigarettes. I think the army at that stage were providing enough. And so I probably, at a guess, I'd probably tell my sister-in-law to stop sending them. No, certain things I mean we could get through the supply line, expect we get what we needed in the way of soap and toiletries.
You mentioned leave. Did you get any leave during this period, or would that be later and before you went to France?
Yes, the leave situation, as far as I recall, nobody got any leave until very much later in the campaign. I didn't get any until actually the war had almost finished.
Yeah.
I gather from reading accounts that, strangely enough, people like officers and certain types of people, like perhaps an occasional sergeant, would be sent on a course I found very strange when I read about it afterwards. I didn't think they could spare these people, and there was a war on. But this did go on, apparently, because it had come out. I think this chap mentions it.
Brownlee Still.
Yes, I think he mentions it. It had gone on, of course, to Lulworth at one stage. That might have been during the period after we got rid of the Shermans.
Now, I think we'll move on then. Helmand was the last thing we talked about, really.
Yeah.
Which you're not sure was before or after Nijmegen, but I mean...
No, it occurred. We were there just a matter of a few days only before the next move took place, and I'm not sure of the order.
That's all right.
What's something I've got to say about, because I haven't written that up properly yet.
What's the next thing you remember, then?
Well, of the Derne area, this would be obviously when our tanks were sort of defending the riverfront area, and they were at a place called Eiselstein, which was spelt, I think, I-J-S-E-L-S-T-E-I-N, Eiselstein. There might have been some people spell it with two letters, I think, at the front, but I don't see the need for that, really. Yes, that's how it's pronounced, I think, Eiselstein, and it was just a remote little hamlet or village near the river, and our tanks were in a more or less static position there, and we could hear distant gunfire at all times, and of course, we didn't know what was going to happen in the way of movement. As it turned out, it was pretty static because it was getting on towards winter then. The weather was deteriorating. We were still living under canvas, so to speak, under a tarpaulin. And our soft vehicles were parked in a pine forest in a wood, in this forest area, just outside this village of Dern. I think the officers had secured for themselves some ruined cottages to build in, you know, to get their night's sleep in, so to speak. We were left to ourselves, so after a while we began to find that as we woke up in the morning, because of the change in the season, we were waking up and finding that our clothing was all damp and nasty, and we had to put it on in this damp condition. And we were even getting quite chilly in the night because our tarpaulin was open-ended. And it just wasn't suitable to sleep like that as the weather was deteriorating. So I had about two other blokes travelling with me at that time. I don't remember their names, but we put our heads together and decided that as the soil in this forest was sandy, it would be quite easy to dig into. And we got this idea of making ourselves a dugout quite near the lorry, because when we finished it, we ran the inspection light, with little inspection light supply, we ran it down from the lorry into the dugout so that we could use it at night and still write our letters and so on, if need be. But anyway, to describe this dugout, what we had to do virtually, we decided we'd make it big enough to sit four men side by side. So we dug out this rectangular pit, and I suppose we got it down to about the height of that barometer there, the top of it. We got down to that sort of depth, about 4 foot perhaps. And then, having got this nice rectangle, we then went out with our matches, and chopped down some slender pine trees. And because they were very tall, we were able to chop them up into sections and put them side by side over this rectangular pit. And then we proceeded to put some ferns, any soft material, between the branches. We stuffed them with ferns, the idea being that we would then pile up the sand on top that we'd excavated, and then having made a mound on the top, over this timber, we would then cover the whole thing with the tarpaulin to stop any rain coming through and make a shelter, so we would be protected from the odd bit of shelling. But then the idea was how to get down into this pit, and so we made this kind of corkscrew channel, starting at ground level and gradually going down, winding in to a corner of this rectangle, where we made a little door with the aid of these ammunition boxes. We nailed these things together, we made a little door and put it on leather hinges, and had a little leather handle to open it and close it. Because what we did, you see, we had a disaster. Once we'd done all this, you see, the weight of all this stuff on the roof caused the sides to cave in. And what happened was, the sides that weren't supporting the weight didn't cave in, but the ends where the poles were resting, they caved in. So one of the other chaps was saying, oh, well, that's it, I'm not going to do it again now. That's made with rust, you know. But anyway, the other chap was wavering, so I persuaded them in the end that we'd done it wrong, that we've got to put some supports in for this timber. So we took it all apart, started again. In the meantime, the prisoner had gone sleeping under the tarpaulin. So we were very keen to get this thing done. And in the end, what we did, we used some more timber and made a sort of a, like a goal post at each end. In fact, we continued it all the way down. We made this framework inside and so forth. Don't the same thing again. But what we did, once we'd done this rectangle, we put a crossbar in the centre. We started stuffing our ammunition laps all the way down to make a sort of panelling. And as we put this panelling, we shoved this spare sand that had collapsed into the pit, we shoved it back, the back of it, and virtually replaced it as we raised the panelling higher. And of course that was then fine once we put the roof on again. We got the support and it didn't collapse again, and we felt safe down there. And after a few days of that, we decided, could we heat it in some way? So we found an old metal ammunition box, an oblong box, and the lid was on hinges, of course, so we stood the box on the end, and with the aid of some of these metal bars that were in the centre of these shell cases, holding the cases together, I think they had wing nut on there, and you could tap holes in this thin metalwork and put these bars in to make a grate at the bottom. So we had to hacksaw the bottom bit so we'd get the ashes out afterwards. So the bottom part of the lid we hacksawed to form a separate door, still attached to one hinge, you see. And then the top door we left as it was for feeding it with. And then how do you get the smoke out, you see? So what we did, empty shell cases, we asked anybody in these empty shell cases, the tank crews, to give us any empty shell cases. And we hacksawed the end off. And because they were tapered, we were able to shove several rounds in together to form a chimney. So we made this chimney resting on the top of the stove and put an old tin on the top, separate, so that the sparks wouldn't be visible from up in the air. And we had some really lovely fires going down there. But the first disaster occurred the first night when we had the fire going. And what happened was the heat. We didn't know where it was coming from at first, but suddenly it started to rain on us. And we couldn't understand it because it wasn't raining outside. And we got the tarpaulin over. But there was all this water descending on us. And we found, of course, it was the heat of the fire was drawing the moisture out of the sand, and it was dripping through the poles down onto us. So we had to hastily remove all our bedding, and we kept stoking the fire up until it had ceased to drip, and then we were able to get back down there again. But you'd be amazed that with all those problems with it, we believe it, you know, we only stayed there a short time. During that period, I had a leave, my first local leave, down to Antwerp. they were arranging weekend, well not weekend, but short leave, what do they call it, 36 hour passes to go down to Antwerp.
And when would this be?
Because somebody's written about this and they've got the exact date right, it must have been only a day or two before we went down to Ypres. So it must have been in the closing stages of our sojourn in Holland that I got this leave. And we were put up in this hotel. And we were, allowed to wander about, do what we liked then. So we'd arrived by truck, put up in the hotel. I think it must have been perhaps the remains of that day and early the next day that we wandered about. But the next day, some of them had decided as a last thing to go to the Rex cinema, which was not far away. And at that time, the Germans had started firing those B-2s on Antwerp, the rockets. And they were trying to stop us using the port, I gather. And anyway, we could hear occasional thuds as these things landed. And then, just at the point, I'd chosen not to go to the cinema. I may have been with somebody else, but I can't remember. I'd chosen to wander around the town and see the sights. I remember going down to the riverside and seeing this old fort down there. I think they called it the old Stein or something, S-T-E-I-N. And I'd come back to the hotel on the second day because we were due to leave at a certain time back to Holland. And it wasn't dark, it wasn't particularly late. It must have been sort of afternoon, late afternoon. So obviously they wanted to get back to Holland before it got dark. And we were told to form up in the corridor in this hotel on the upper floor. And just as we were formed up, we left our bedrooms, got our kit out, there was this almighty thud. And we heard all the glass in the windows tinkling down inside. Got blown out with the blast. And we didn't know at the time, but this rocket had landed on this cinema, the Rex, and some of our casualties occurred there. It was a terrible thing. I believe the account says that there were several hundred people killed there. But certainly, I've visited the graves of two of our chaps that were killed there. They're buried just outside Antwerp in a military cemetery. And not at that time, of course. This was years later. So I think we knew very little. I think at that point, I do remember that we were most anxious to leave Antwerp, that we thought of the two, being in the front line in Holland was preferable to being in Antwerp when those rockets were around. And I'm sure the people in London at that time felt the same. So we were glad to get back into that truck and away. I expect it was only later that we heard news of what had actually happened on that cinema.
So when you got back, you say you weren't there long before...
No, the next thing I knew was we had to leave this super dugout.
Would you just leave it, or would you take all the stuff you could from it again?
Oh, we'd simply leave it and take our bedding out, of course. But I don't think we got the stage of having any pin-ups on the walls or anything like that. It was basic, but it was luxury compared with scraping.
But you wouldn't bother taking the chimney with you, things like that?
Oh, no, it would be left. I often wondered what the local inhabitants thought, because, you see, we were the very first ones to build the dugout, and it took on right the way down the column, all the vehicles in these woods, and they all started building them, and they all had their own variations, and eventually the officer, Major Grant, got to know about it, and he came round to inspect them all, and I think he was rather sorry that he was in this bombed out house. I think he would have probably preferred something like that. He would have felt safer. Because he was a rather nervous individual, I think.
Did it show much?
No, I think he put a sort of a mask on. He put a cover on. I think this is why, basically, most of the time he was irritable. I think he was irritable because, firstly, he wasn't in a very fit condition. He was rather old for a campaign of that sort. I mean, not very old as age goes, but I mean, a bit old for that sort of thing. At a guess, I would think he was well on into his 40s at that time. And he had this disability. He was obviously had some slight disability with one of his legs. He always walked in a funny way. He couldn't really march like the rest of us.
Did his nerves affect his ability to carry out his duty, would you say, or was he all, you know?
No, I would say he controlled himself in that sense, but I think he put on a show of fierceness to cover up, you know, what was going on inside him.
How could you tell then?
Well, because he did some strange things. He sort of punished people unnecessarily and made a big thing out of nothing. And that way you sort of got the feeling that he was trying to cover up something.